This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sue Diaz, never expected her son Roman to become a soldier, never expected him to go to war. But instead of college in 2002, he chose the paycheck, health benefits, and money that came with joining the Army. He thought the structure and discipline would be good for him, too. He did two deployments in Iraq, 27 months. One of those deployments was at the height of the insurgency in the area known as the Triangle of Death, 20 miles south of Baghdad. His platoon suffered a particularly high death toll. He was injured by an IED. Sue Diaz has written a memoir called Minefields of the Heart about what it was like at home when her son was at war. She's written essays for the Christian Science Monitor and Newsweek. She's also conducted writing workshops for veterans at the San Diego Vet Center and created a website for the writings of veterans around the country. Sue Diaz, welcome to Fresh Air. You write that your son never played with guns. Was that because you didn't want him to?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you were raising him to not be a gun kind of guy, so it must have really shocked you when he joined the military.
Yeah, you know, not the military so much, but the infantry was the real shocker.
Why was that the real shocker?
Well, I mean, the infantry is the boots on the ground, the guys carrying the guns.
And why did he join the infantry?
He actually qualified for every job that the Army offered, so he had his pick of anything. And he chose the infantry. And he said, you know, it offered the largest signing bonus, and my thought was, well, there's a reason for that.
You actually offered him money to stay and not join the infantry.
I did, yeah. Well, and it wasn't not to join the military, but it was the infantry. And the bonus was, at that time, $10,000. And I had a CD from an aunt of mine. It was an inheritance thing, and it was sitting in the credit union. And I said, I will give you this bonus for not joining the infantry. It wasn't a thing to bribe him not to join the military. It was the infantry thing that I was really bent out of shape about, I think.
Now, when he joined the infantry, it was in 2002. Mm-hmm. You opposed the war in Iraq. Your husband supported it. Did your son have a political opinion about the war in Iraq, and did that come into play at all in his decision to join?
I would say no. I mean, I don't really want to speak for him about that. I would say, you know, politics, it was sort of on the periphery, really, of his thinking. It was more of a life choice, not a political statement.
So give us an overview of when and where he served in Iraq.
He served with the 1st Armored Division. That was his first tour of duty. And that was also in and near Baghdad, in what was called the Triangle of Death. But his first tour of duty, the group that he served with, they seemed to live a charmed life, actually. It wasn't until the very end of their year-long deployment that they lost someone in their company. He actually said to us on occasion that, you know, bridges blow up after we cross them and mortars land in a barracks after we've left. And it seemed to be, I mean, they had a reputation for being golden at that time, actually. It wasn't nearly as difficult as his second deployment. So he came back from that and was transferred to the 101st Airborne. I think he chose the 101st Airborne. They're based in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. You know, he went there, and shortly after he arrived there, it was announced that the 101st Airborne would be going to Iraq. So, you know, he had maybe 6 months or 8 months in between deployments, and then was headed back to Iraq once again with 1st Battalion, 502nd Infantry Regiment, Bravo Company, 1st Platoon.
Well, while he was in the military, you worried about getting the phone call or the knock at the door. And you mm-hmm. got one of those phone calls about an IED mm-hmm. explosion. Tell us about mm-hmm. the call.
It was 2 days before Christmas that the phone rang, and it was early in the morning. And a voice, you know, asked, is this Susan Diaz? And I said, yes. I thought it was a telemarketer. It had that kind of formality to it. And then the voice said, you know, this is Captain Kandrian of the 101st Airborne, and there's been an incident. Your son has been involved in an IED explosion. And he said, do you know what an IED is? And it was like, Yeah. I mean, those three letters were as familiar to me as PTA used to be. And he went on to say that he wasn't, you know, injured seriously, that he had suffered some wounds and was being patched up at the aid station in Mahmoudiya, and that we probably wouldn't hear from him for a while because there was a news blackout. And I asked him about that. You know, what do you mean, a news blackout? And then he explained, he said, whenever there's an incident and soldiers are killed, that they don't allow the soldiers in that unit to contact their families until the next of kin of those who have been lost have been contacted. And so then that indicated to me sort of the seriousness of this explosion. And there were two soldiers that were lost in that. And, you know, I mean, I remember at the time, you know, writing down the name of the place where that happened, Mahmoudiya, and asking the captain to spell it. I mean, I remember being very kind of focused and almost meticulous about taking notes about this as if that would somehow make right what I was hearing.
What the captain told you was that your son had suffered a perforated eardrum, right, and that his face was peppered. And I'm sure your instincts was, as a mother, was like, send him home so he can rest and heal so we could take care of him. But you were told, well, you know, the injuries aren't serious, so he's going to just, like, heal briefly and go right back to combat. How did that make you feel?
Well, you know, sad, disappointed. I mean, even in the hearing that terrible news, there was this element of hope that maybe, you know, he would come home to us and heal and be okay. But that, you know, that wasn't the case. And I later learned that the explosion was very serious. I mean, they said that it was four guys on foot patrol and the IED exploded beneath their feet, but it was powerful enough to be heard 10 miles away. And in another book written about my son's platoon, Black Hearts by Jim Frederick, he talks about that incident, and he says that, he writes, all four of those men should have been dead. And it was quite something to read that.
If the IED explosion happened almost under your son's feet, how did he survive?
That's a very good question. And in Jim Frederick's book, he asked that same question, and the answer is that whoever planted that large IED somehow didn't have it pointed in the right direction. I mean, it was supposed to be, some part of it was supposed to be pointing straight up, and it was angled. So they did a poor job of planting it. And because it was angled the way it was, I mean, the power of the explosion was still there, but the force of it went in a different direction. So that was probably the thing that saved him.
Well, this is one of the amazing parts of your story, is that, you know, your son tells you really very little about what his life in combat is like. And then years later, after he's returned, this year, in fact, in 2010, Jim Frederick publishes this book, Black Hearts, One Platoon's Descent into Madness in Iraq's Triangle of Death.
Right.
And you read that, and your son is one of the men being written about. And some terrible things happened. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but it was in this book that you learned that your son, it was amazing that he survived this IED explosion. And I'm wondering what it was like to read this book and find out through a book what had actually happened to your son, as opposed to hearing it from him firsthand.
Well, I mean, Roman is Roman, and he never really has been much of a talker. And so this wasn't like a new kind of a new shutting down. I mean, he has always been a very private person. But when the book came out, I knew the day that it was coming out, and I went to the bookstore and purchased it. And you know, read it from start to finish in a day, really, and felt afterwards shaken to my core. It's a story of an extremely difficult deployment on many, many levels. During the worst time of the war, when Roman's unit was there, when his battalion was there, the region around Mahmoudiya was patrolled by 1,000 soldiers who encountered, on the average, about 100 attacks per week. His battalion in 1 year encountered 900 IEDs. And later, after the surge and when things had quieted down, in that same area around Mahmoudia and Yusufiya, 30,000 troops were brought in to cover that same area. So it gives you some idea of what these men were up against.
Do you feel lucky that you didn't know about that as it was happening?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, I think on some level, anyone who has someone in a combat zone, I think in some deep corner of your heart, you know the kind of danger that you're in, that they're in. You know, you don't really go there, but you know that that's there, I think. And I know, like, when Roman was there, there were deaths reported in the newspapers, and I didn't know exactly how bad it was. I mean, I remember we did get a letter from him, and he talked about, he said, oh, I haven't written to you for a while, but I think I ought to let you know what's going on here. And this was shortly after they arrived with the 101st Airborne into this area, Mahmoudia and Yusufiya. And he said, we're out here kind of away from things. We have our food dropped off by helicopter. You know, our supplies are dropped in by helicopter. We're kind of out here on our own. And I remember reading that at the time and thinking, oh, you know, they're in some like remote area where maybe they're sort of keeping an eye on a distant border, and that's why the helicopter is dropping those things, you know, off. And so I fooled myself into thinking that, you know, that indicated that they were in a safe place. But as it turns out, the reason that the helicopter was dropping the things off is that the roads surrounding that area were just deemed too dangerous for supply trucks to travel. And these were the roads that every single day they got in the Humvees to go on patrol, they walked. So that fact says a lot, I think.
I remember interviewing an author who said that she was always so worried about her children that, for example, whenever they would take a long plane ride and she was worried about the plane crashing or something, that she'd clean the house, she'd wash the kitchen floor, she would do anything that was not pleasurable because she was afraid if she had pleasure that would superstitiously put her children in danger. Mm-hmm. So she'd wash the floor. Did you have any superstitions that you developed, things that you needed to do to keep your son safe?
I would sometimes, compartmentalize. I mean, I would just take that fear and that terror, and I would almost picture myself putting it someplace else, putting it in a box, so to speak. And I would know it was there. I would go there from time to time, but I could not live there. And you can't. I mean, life goes on, even against the backdrop of, you know, of these incredible dangers that our loved ones face over there. But, you know, life goes on here, and it has to. And I think on some level that they want to know that too, that they find some comfort in knowing that, okay, we're here, we're protecting you, but they want to know that that life as they knew it is still there.
We talked earlier about the IED that exploded and was heard 10 miles away and that nearly killed him, but amazingly he survived with, you know, with mild injuries. But it turns out the injuries weren't really as mild as originally diagnosed because he had TBI. I assume it was from that blast?
He was involved in several explosions peripherally, but I think it was from that one, yeah.
And I should say TBI is traumatic brain injury, when the brain is kind of shaken up so much by something like a blast that there's damage that's caused that went undiagnosed for a long time and is still going undiagnosed in a lot of places. How is your son diagnosed?
Well, he's been seen by, you know, doctors and therapists at the VA, you know, since his return. And, you know, there are different degrees of traumatic brain injury, and his, I would say, is milder than some. It affects his ability to his sense of direction and his memory, his short-term memory especially, he's able to, you know, to function and stuff. But it makes life that much harder. And he's in college right now. He's going to the Art Institute of California up in Orange County. He's a full-time student. And things that he used to be able to do, you know, turn around in half an hour, projects, programming projects or web projects, now takes him, you know, much, much longer. So there, you know, there, it's an ongoing struggle, really.
He's also been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. Do you see the symptoms of that?
Occasionally, yeah, from time to time, yeah. As all people who have that, I think, are can be quicker to anger sometimes. And, you know, a little antsy in crowds or I've noticed this actually with the veterans in the writing groups that I lead now. They'll tell me about it or they'll demonstrate it where if they're sitting in a room, they want to be their back to the wall and their eyes to the door. And that's something that they'll do all their lives probably.
So how close to you geographically does your son live now?
It's about a two-hour drive. He lives up in Lawndale, which is in the L.A. area.
Yeah, that's not bad.
So it's about 2 hours on the I-5. He's married now, too, so we see him and his wife quite often. They were down maybe about a week and a half ago helping with some hedge trimming in the backyard. So.
Your father served in World War II, right?
Yes.
Did he talk about the war?
No, he didn't. There was a time where I once discovered, when I was about 10 years old, he had an office in the basement of our house in Wisconsin, and in a drawer in that office, I was looking for something else and opened that bottom drawer and found a shoebox full of black and white photos that he had brought home with him from the war, and I can still see the faces and those images in those photos. I mean, he landed on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. He fought through to Paris, and then toward the end of the war, he was involved in liberating some of the concentration camps, or one of them. I think it was Bergen-Belsen. I'm not sure about that, but it was a concentration camp. And there were photos of you know, that were taken in the war by, I don't know if it was by him or other soldiers, but he had those photos. And I remember seeing those photos and you know, realizing in some 10-year-old way that what the hell of war and what that was for him.
I've asked you to describe some of the most horrific things that happened to your son and your reaction to it, but tell us what it was like when he came home from his final tour and you got to see him still intact.
It was wonderful. And I remember, you know, we flew to Fort Campbell, Kentucky from California to be there when the plane landed, when his unit finally came home. And I remember sitting in the big sort of cavernous hangar, really, which is where the families gather, and the door opening and the sunlight behind the men and them marching in and just the place erupting in pure joy to see them. And you know, they march in front of you and you're in the bleachers and you can't touch them. You can't throw your arms around them yet. They're standing there. And, you know, I remember Roman looking up and seeing us and, you know, we're waving and his eyebrows lifting. And it was, you know, it's a moment that a parent or anyone in that situation never forgets. And I remember when finally the songs were sung and the speeches were given and then they said, you know, okay, you can break ranks and be reunited with your families. And, you know, finding him on the floor, I mean, it's just a swarm of people, everyone looking for their soldier. And finally, throwing my arms around him and, you know, simply saying, Roman, and hearing him saying, Mom, and, you know, thinking, you know, that was all that we said, but that was everything in that moment.
Sue Diaz, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Sue Diaz is the author of the memoir Minefields of the Heart, A Mother's Stories of a Son at War. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Listening to Abby Lincoln's records can move you to tears because of her beautiful voice and her honesty when she sings of joy or pain. It made me really sad to hear she died Saturday. She was 80. We're going to play excerpts of two interviews with Abby Lincoln from our archive. Lincoln started her career in the early 1950s as a nightclub singer, cultivating a seductive image, wearing evening gowns and singing romantic ballads. Her public image and self-image started to change in the late 50s when she met drummer and bebop pioneer Max Roach, who introduced her to modern jazz and a performing style influenced by the civil rights movement. They recorded a series of albums together and were married from 1962 to 1970. Later in her career, she became known for the songs she wrote as well as the ones she interpreted. Abby Lincoln also had an acting career. She performed in the rock and roll movie The Girl Can't Help It, starred in the 1964 film Nothing But a Man, co-starred opposite Sidney Poitier in For the Love of Ivy, and was in Spike Lee's movie Mo Better Blues. Here's one of Abby Lincoln's early recordings from 1956.
Love walked right in and drove the shadows away. Love walked right in and brought my sunniest day. That love said hello. Though not a word was spoken.
The first of the two Abby Lincoln interviews we'll hear is from 1986. She told me how she got interested in music.
I'm one of 12 children, and there's an old piano in the house that my father furnished for us. And I was the only one, seemingly, who was interested in the piano. I found solace there and a companionship, just sitting and picking out a melody on the piano because it didn't get on my mother's nerves, thank goodness.
So the music you heard on the farm was mostly church music?
I didn't hear much music on the farm. The music that I made, really, there was a victrola, and songs that seemed way far away somehow.
Like from another culture?
Yes.
What songs were those?
One was called, it was a man singing a song about a pal. Oh, pal, oh, gal, you left me all alone, a sad song. And somebody told me that it was about a dog. But I thought, well, it could have been about a dog, but it was somebody that he loved a lot. Things like that. Hymns that we learned in church. But that was not my inspiration for singing. When I was 14, my sister brought a recording home of Billie Holiday and Coleman Hawkins the same day. I heard them both, and he was playing Body and Soul. I don't remember what Billie was singing.
When you started singing in nightclubs, well, judging from the cover anyways of the That's Him record, you were wearing
That's
later on. Yeah.
Yes, I started as Anna Marie. That's the name my people named me. Anna Marie Wooldridge is the name I was born to. And I met a man named Bob Russell who named me Abby Lincoln and introduced me to the svelte, chic world of the supper club.
Was it hard to fit into it, having come from a farm in Michigan?
Yes, because I never really felt it. You know, they talked about my being sexy and they said all these things because I had a press agent, of course, you know. And they decided that was the image that they were going to put forth of this wonderful-looking woman who didn't have much talent, though. I mean, she couldn't sing much. This is what I got. They were interested in making money, and I was just biding my time until I found me a man. But in the process of all this, I'm saying I learned to not trust myself because I wasn't studying to be truly an artist. By the time I met Roach, I was already had made the cover of Ebony magazine, and I had made a movie with Jane Mansfield called A Girl Can't Help It. And I had a career that I hadn't planned, but still I was there. And so I left that and went with Roach, with Max. He told me that I didn't have to do things like that.
What did you think when he told you that?
I was relieved.
Uh-huh.
And I believed him because I knew he was a great artist. I had a chance to watch him perform in California. I didn't know anything about Max Roach or Charlie Parker or none of these people because I wasn't approaching the music from that standpoint. I knew the people who were popular, who I'd hear on the radio, and I happened to like Billie Holiday and Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald and Peggy Lee. There's a lot of people who I heard, Lena Horne.
So you met many other jazz musicians.
I met the jazz musicians when I met Max Roach.
And you started recording with jazz musicians.
I started recording. Yes, I started to work with virtuoso musicians for the first time in my life. This is really what happened to me. I didn't know what a virtuoso artist was until I met this crowd of musicians and singers. Even though I was listening to Billie Holiday, I didn't know who she was, really. I was singing the best I could. But there's a kind of a culture that this music is, and I wasn't involved in that then.
How did it change your singing? Did you find, like, your phrasing changed or that you would interpret a song any differently with the different kind of accompaniment?
No. I'm still myself. I'm myself, but I'm more myself now. There were pointers for instance, Max would say to me, sing on the beat, because I had a tendency to sing a long line. And I knew where the beat was, but I figured it was somebody else's business and not my own. And I would say to him, well, the band didn't swing. He said to me, you're supposed to swing. You're supposed to be the rhythm section. Things like that.
I'd like to play a 1957 recording that you made, which features Max Roach on drums, and Kenny Dorham, Sonny Rollins, Wynton Kelly, Paul Chambers all perform on it. How did this session come to be?
I had come to New York to do a screen test for the Billie Holiday story. This was years ago. And they told me that after I'd come and taken an apartment and everything, they told me that they were going to use Lana Turner or somebody like that, or Ava Gardner. Really, truly, this is the truth, Terry. But anyway, I was in New York, and I was seeing Max Roach. And he said to me, how would you like to make a jazz album? And I said, I'm not a jazz singer. And he said, you're black, aren't you? That's when I started to see myself through the music on another level. I never thought of music on this level before. I used to sing songs that Billie Holiday and Sarah and the other singers would sing. And I didn't know what I was saying, really. I was just singing. I would sing My Man. But I discovered I didn't want that in my life. If I met a man like that, I know what to do for him. You just leave him alone, you know? I didn't want to sing sad songs. And this masochistic woman who tells all, it never appealed to me. So, and since it was done so well, I mean, Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday and, well, Ethel Waters, many women have told this side of the story. Now there's something else to say, and I believe I'm the one to say it.
Let's listen to this 1957 recording with my guest, Abby Lincoln.
Civilians, I'd pick him out in the darkest caves and hallways. I would know him always beyond a doubt. Identification comes easily to me because when there is autumn in the air. That's him. That's him. The way you feel when Antoine has just finished with your hair. That's him. That's him. You know the way you feel when you smell bread baking. The way you feel when suddenly a tooth stops aching. Wonderful world, wonderful you. That's him. That's him. He is.
That's Abby Lincoln, recorded in 1957. The interview we heard was recorded in 1986. Abby Lincoln died Saturday at the age of 80. We'll continue our tribute with a 1993 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering jazz singer and songwriter Abby Lincoln. She died Saturday at the age of 80. The next interview we'll hear with her from our archive was recorded in 1993.
Let me play one of the songs that you wrote that you recorded on one of your recent albums. And this is called I've Got Thunder
yes.
and It Rings. It's a great song.
Thank you.
Tell me something about writing it, about what you wanted to say about yourself in this song.
Well, there's a complaint about the woman, about the female, you know, especially about black women. I don't know. I guess it's the same thing for all the women. But if you express yourself, they say you talk too much and you don't know how to be feminine and you're a drag, you know. So I said, listen, this is all true. So run, because I'm not changing anything. I'm everything that you say I am. So don't come around here, because love is an emotion that'll move you to do things, to say things, and to be things, whether it pleases anybody or not.
Well, let's hear Abby Lincoln singing her own song, I've Got Thunder and It Rings. And this is from her album, The World is Falling Down.
Some folks talk about my power. Some folks say I'm wild and strong. Others say my style of living makes a man go wrong. I'm a woman hard to handle. If you need to handle things, better run. When I start coming, I've got thunder and it rings. It'll move you to do things, do things, do things. Love is an emotion. It'll move you to do things. I got thunder and it rings. Some folks talk about the love they're feeling.
That's Abby Lincoln singing her own song. When you started your career as a singer, you worked as a glamorous nightclub singer, evening gowns, the whole bit. As a matter of fact, one writer described you as being packaged as the Black Julie London. Do you think that that's appropriate?
No, they used to compare me to Lena Horne. At that time, everybody was trying to be beautiful as Lena Horne.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Eartha Kitt, who was supposed to be a kitten. And you were supposed to have a glamorous image. And for the first time, I was using my physical look to attract attention to me. And to it was a claim to fame. And it wasn't anything that I'd ever done before, because we were taught not to do that anyway. It's vanity.
Did it affect your relationship with men to be the
yes.
sexy kitten on stage?
Because they believe, men and women, we all believe what we see on the screen. And people thought I was this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I played that role. Why would they think anything else? So I went from there to this warrior woman. And that befuddled everybody, too, because they thought, oh, why don't you shut up? I think I've had that said to me more than anything in the world over the years when I was younger. You talk too much, you know. Don't rock the boat. Even though they're miserable, people are miserable, they'll tell you this, but you're not supposed to say anything about it. So when I discovered that there was the world of the artist, it saved my life because I could strive to be individual and as best as I could be. I didn't have to have money. I didn't have to have anything except my life. And I went for that, and I'm glad I did.
You said that when you discovered jazz and the world of the artist that you turned into a woman warrior.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what you were like as the woman warrior then.
Well, the first thing I did, I just started to wear my hair natural. That was a crime in 1958. A black woman wasn't supposed to show that she had hair like she had. It was a disgrace to have this kind of hair that they call all these crazy names. So I just glorified my existence. And I said, this is me, and this is my beautiful self, you know. The beauticians thought I was going to ruin their business. They did. They said I was after their business. And a lot of people said things. And I started singing songs that were more social. I started writing songs, and I found songs that would express what was in my heart. Because, you know, Billie Holiday was like this. She didn't sing inane things. She sang about the life that she lived. She may have been masochistic and all these things, but she sang Strange Fruit. And God bless the child that's got his own. It's the same reason they remember Bessie Smith, because these were social singers. They weren't just... It wasn't self-aggrandizement, standing in front of people saying how great I am. But they were singing songs about the people's lives.
I want to play a recording that you made of a song very associated with Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
And it's a very masochistic song, I don't explain. But it's a beautiful song, nevertheless. You know.
Yes, forgiving.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful melody, and I love the way you sing it.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit before we hear it about the influence Billie Holiday had on you. I think you're a very different singer than she is, although I hear the influence that she's had on you. But tell me a bit about that influence, and also if you knew her, if you met her.
I met her when I was about 23 in Honolulu, and she came to the bar where I was working. It was probably to get away from where she was working because the place was jammed with people. Anyway, she came to see me a couple of times, and I'd run to catch her show, and I saw her magic on the stage, this beautiful woman who would stand perfectly still with her hands like she was like a doll, and her eyes would slide from one side of the room to the other, and the room was perfectly still. And... I fell further in love with her. This was my... Because I was singing a lot of songs that she sang already that I learned on the radio, from the radio. But Billie Holiday was always honest. She didn't bend a note to make her voice sound good. It was in conversation that she sang. And she was sincere and honest, and she never made a record for money. And to me, she's the greatest singer of her era.
So do you think what you learned from Billie Holiday wasn't how to phrase as much as it was that you should be yourself?
Yes. Yes.
Let's hear your recording of Don't Explain, back from 1957, from your album That's Him, your first jazz recording.
Hush now, don't explain. Just say you'll remain. Glad you're back. Don't explain. Hush now. Don't explain. my joy and pain. Skip that lipstick. Don't explain.
That's Abby Lincoln singing Don't Explain. You and Max Roach got married during the period that you were recording together.
Yes.
How did you like married life? And I'm wondering if your career ended up taking a back seat at all during
your
marriage.
No, he's a great artist and would never ask another artist to do that.
Uh-huh.
But marriage is the pit. You know why?
Why?
Because I'm a polygamous woman. I don't want him to be everything to a man. And I don't want him trying being everything to me. He's got his mother. I want to know if he loves his mother first. I want to know if he loves his first wife, if he got along with her or if he gets along with her. I just don't like this approach to marriage, and I will never do it again. I don't want to be that to anybody. I don't want anybody coming into my bedroom as if it's theirs. I have to have my own space, and I expect him to have his own. If he doesn't know how to have his own space, I don't want him around me.
So never again.
No, not that style.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. On the liner notes of one of your early records, someone quotes Thelonious Monk as having said to you the first time he saw you sing, "I like the way you stand."
No, he never said anything like that to me. Thelonious Monk wouldn't say anything like that to anybody in the first place. He doesn't give a damn about the way you stand. Excuse me, Lord. Thelonious Monk said to me, after listening to the words that I had written to his song, Blue Monk, he said to me, he came to where I was and whispered in my ear, "Don't be so perfect." And I said to Max Roach, "You know what Thelonious said to me?" He said, "Don't be so perfect." What did he mean? And Roach said, "He means make a mistake." And I didn't know what either one of them were talking about.
So how do you interpret that now?
It means that you must reach for something. You have to reach for the sky. If you don't make it, at least you reached for it. So your voice cracked, but you reached for it. You don't play safe. It's not safe, Jones. You take a chance on making a mistake. That's what they meant. And I do. I've learned to sing like that.
Well, I just saw you sing in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago, and it was a great performance.
Thank you.
And I don't know, it seems like when I see you on stage that you really are feeling the material that you sing. You're not falling back on professionalism or show business or anything. You seem to really be reaching inside each time you perform.
That's true. It's the way of the music. Thelonious Monk would be drenched in perspiration and absolutely possessed. Nina Simone, Billie Holiday, and Charlie Parker, even though I didn't see him, but I hear it in his music. It's a possession. It's the muse. They talk about the muse. I'm possessed of a muse, and I belong to her, and she belongs to me, and as long as I sing and I am real and I do nothing to betray the trust, this is what I do. And it's a wonderful experience to come to the stage and to know that everything is all right.
That interview with Abby Lincoln was recorded in 1993. Her final album, Abby Sings Abby, devoted to her original songs, was recorded in 2006. When it was released in 2007, she was recovering from open-heart surgery. Here's the final track of that final album. The song is called Being Me.
All along the way, there were things to do. Always some other someone I could be. Other things to know, other ways to go, to fly a spirit for the stage, the show.
It wasn't always easy learning to be me. Sometimes my head and heart would disagree. Times I walked away, other times I'd stay to see the drama of my life play. Being me,
Abby Lincoln died Saturday at the age of 80. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.